and gentlemen, welcome once again to APM's Evening of CPD, 90 minutes of live CPD, Councillors Learning with Others for the UK Osteopaths and Chiropractors. I want to start, though, with a big thank you to our very loyal and growing band of watchers out there. I know we do have the occasional technical glitch, and you're very patient, you put up with those, and I know you do it because the quality of what we deliver is pretty impressive. We're doing this, I think, probably at the cutting edge of internet broadcast technology. And the problem with that, of course, is that it means that we do occasionally suffer from little foul-ups. But we do it in order that we can get the best stuff to you. It means we take this roadshow to our speakers every time we deliver one of these broadcasts. It means we can have a great variety of speakers. It means we can have a huge quality in the range of osteopathy and other CPD that we deliver. Our aim and what we're trying to do here is to make it watchable, to make it entertaining, and most of all, to make it useful and informative for all the therapists who are part of the audience. We could deliver this in the way that boring old ordinary webinars are delivered, which you would get a PowerPoint slide and an anonymous voice behind it. But we don't want to do that because we want you engaged and we want you interested and listening. And I think, and I hope, and I'm reassured by the comments and the feedback that we get that that's what we are delivering to you. So once again, a thank you to the audience. We're at the cutting edge of technology, as I say, but this has been one of the calmest introductions we have had to one of our broadcasts so far. And I kind of feel that calm has descended on us because we're going to be talking this evening about the cranial approach to treatment. We've come to Nottingham, where we're going to be talking to Nick Woodhead. Nick is one of the founding directors of the Roland Becker Institute. He's a lecturer at the BSO, the British School of Osteopathy, both at undergraduate and postgraduate level. He is a external examiner for the Osteopathic Centre for Children, and he also lectures at the Vienna School of Osteopathy. So we have a real expert in the cranial approach in our midst, and I'm sure that even those of you who don't practice cranial therapy will learn a lot from this. After all, the point is not just to tell you about what you do, it's to tell you what other therapies are out there and how they perhaps can complement your own training. Nick, welcome to our studio.
Thank you, good evening.
A pleasure to have you here. First of all, as I've said to you before, we have a number of people in our audience who are not perhaps not osteopaths, but certainly not cranial therapists. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about the Roland Becker Institute?
Certainly can. Could I firstly pick up on the term cranial therapy, which is something that I don't particularly enjoy. I prefer to say cranial approach.
Did I say cranial therapy?
You
I
did
said cranial
indeed.
Approach, didn't I? My apologies to everybody.
Purely and simply because I want to emphasise that I don't see the way that I work and the way I practice and my colleagues in the Becker Institute. I don't see what we do as a technique so much as a more embracing approach founded on a sort of a conceptual model, shall we say. And as we talk along about this subject, I think it will become apparent to everybody that we're not just talking about heads, which is an important point to make. Yes. But to explain to you about the Roland Becker Institute, I and two or three of my colleagues in the Roland Becker Institute were privileged to have been taught by Roland Becker when he was obviously still alive and when he was visiting the British School of Osteopathy in the 1970s and 1980s. The founding father of the cranial approach, most people accept, is Will Sutherland, and we put a lot of emphasis on Will Sutherland's contribution. But I personally feel, and I know this is shared by colleagues, that Roland Becker took things a step or two further from Will Sutherland's discoveries. Roland particularly emphasised the importance of what you might call a dialogue by palpation with the patient's body that you're working with. Listening, obviously with touch, but listening to what information is given through the micro-motion that we feel as we work with our patients, and then responding therapeutically, well, not just therapeutically, initially diagnostically, but then therapeutically with our hands. So Roland talked in terms of the concept of what he described as the silent partner, meaning that inherent intelligence in the patient's body. He also used the term physician within, the concept that the answers are in the patient's body and it's for us to interpret them as best we can and assist that. He talked about the osteopath being the junior partner in that relationship. So we wanted to emphasise that flavour to the cranial or involuntary approach to treatment. There are a number of approaches that are taught in the UK and throughout the world. We feel that we're emphasising and trying to keep alive Roland Becker's message, which is simple, but we feel quite fundamental.
This is an extension, really, of the whole body's capability to heal itself, isn't it?
Indeed, yes.
Which I think every therapist, whether conventional or otherwise, would accept. And we're just trying to do our best to help it along.
Indeed. I think. Could I add that this is a personal view, of course, yeah. And I suppose you and your audience want to hear personal views. For me, I feel that working in the way that I've tried to just describe means that I can get closer to that that self-healing principle that's in our patients' bodies, real time. I feel as though I can feel it happening as it happens and work with it as it happens. Having practiced as an osteopath using a more conventional direct approach, I've always felt in my early days of practice that I didn't have the same contact. I don't mean just hand contact, but the same involvement and integration with that healing, self-healing principle.
So how long did you practice as an osteopath before you adopted a more cranial approach?
I was introduced to the cranial approach very early on.
At undergraduate level?
A little bit. The cranial or involuntary approach was a bit taboo in the 1970s in the BSO, so it was a little bit, not quite under the counter, but you know. Yes. But me and my contemporaries were introduced to it towards the end of our training, and quite a few of us decided to do a postgraduate course. That's really all that was available in the 1970s.
And so you've basically been doing the cranial approach since 1980-ish?
Since the late 70s, yes. Yeah. And initially I was using a more conventional direct approach and some involuntary or cranial work. Yeah. But gradually my interest and my emphasis on the cranial approach became bigger and bigger and bigger. I think I could exemplify that by saying, having worked in an established practice for 2 years where I was very well supported with the cranial approach, and then my wife, who's already also an osteopath, and I started practicing in Nottingham in 1979. I drifted back to using the more direct technical approach because that was what was expected of me by my patients. But I wasn't very satisfied with what I was doing. I wasn't actually getting terribly good results. And so I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to lose this patient because they're not getting better, I might as well have lost them having done what I think is doing my level best. So after about 6 or 9 months of practicing in Nottingham, I shifted much more towards using the cranial approach, and that's been my path ever since. It's right for me. I'm not saying it's right for everybody.
Do you do any structural treatment?
Very little, probably no more than about 5% of structural work now.
Right.
Examples of when I do use structural work are on, for example, adolescents with organic orthopaedic scoliosis, and I've two young women I'm treating at the moment who are in that situation. I use a combination of involuntary and direct technical approaches.
Yeah.
And I think the other area of the body where I'm inclined to use direct technical approach is feet.
Right. Yeah. And are you in a clinic with non-cranial practitioners?
Everybody in the practice here in Nottingham works cranially to an extent. I don't expect my fairly recently qualified colleague, who's been qualified only a year, to go wholeheartedly into the cranial approach, but the practice here we have in Nottingham has very strong cranial flavour, and I like to think we've got a reasonable reputation for that.
Yeah.
Horses for courses. I have highly respected colleagues around the city who are very good technicians using more direct techniques. I'd be honoured to be treated by them if I needed treatment. They attract their own sort of style of clientele, as indeed we do.
Well, that leads me on to something I was going to ask. First of all, what caused the change in approach at the British School of Osteopathy? But also, what's the extent of cross-referral between you and other osteopaths, between you and conventional practitioners or chiropractors or sports
practitioners? Certainly, we will refer from our practice to colleagues who are direct technique practitioners, and vice versa. I wouldn't say that it's happening every week particularly, but it's a fairly free cross-referral, not mentioning names, but yes, there are people in this city where we've got a good working relationship to cross-refer. I'm not quite clear what you meant about the change of emphasis.
Well, you said
in
the 70s that the cranial approach was under the counter. It wasn't taught, it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was frowned upon, but people didn't consider it at undergraduate level.
Not very
clearly,
much.
You're teaching it at undergraduate level now, so there has been a change in attitude and philosophy.
Yeah, to an extent, and that's taken a whole generation to happen. Yeah. Historically, cranial work in the UK was not exclusively, but largely influenced by Colin Dove, who was principal at the BSO in those days. I think the story is that Colin was effectively sent to the US to do a cranial course so that he could come back and criticise it and, shall we say, rubbish it from an informed perspective. But it didn't work because Colin Dove was was completely captivated by the cranial approach, having spent some time with American colleagues. So that was 1974, I think. He was also there in the US with Martin Pascoe, who's who was my predecessor, really, at the BSO. Yeah. I think that probably it was the early 80s when a growing interest in the involuntary or cranial approach was taking place in the profession, that the BSO kind of caught up with that. I just mentioned Martin Pascoe, who is not only an osteopath but also qualified as a dentist, and he was employed at the BSO to introduce the cranial concept into the undergraduate course. So that took place in the late 1980s, by which time on the postgraduate level we had large numbers of doing people doing cranial courses, like 80, 88 people on a course. So the popularity of the profession by the late 80s had grown substantially, and it was then that it was integrated into undergraduate training by Martin.
Perhaps we should move on. Now, there will be people in our audience, as I've said, who are not osteopaths, and they're not cranial therapists. There will be osteopaths who don't practice the cranial approach.
Sure.
And I might throw up my hand here and say that my knowledge of the cranial approach is somewhat rusty. So run us through the philosophy, the thinking behind it.
Certainly.
If you would.
Building on what I've said already about this, the strong emphasis, shall we say, on the body being a self-regulating and self-healing organism, which I think we all are bought into. It's not special to osteopathy, and it's certainly not special to the involuntary approach. Historically, osteopathic colleagues might know the story of Will Sutherland, who was, as I say, first credited really with the person who tripped over this. Sutherland became fascinated by the sutural architecture in a skull which had been dismantled in the American School of Osteopathy when he was a student there at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. And he sort of started to think that maybe the sutural architecture was there to allow some movement. It looked too elaborate for the skull just to be an ossified structure in adulthood. Talked to his teachers at the time about this idea, and they said, put it out of your mind, dismiss it, sort of thing. But it kept eating away at him, and over quite a long time, many years, Sutherland did some self-experimentation. He got the skull that he'd studied with himself, dismantled it, and found that the sutural architecture was very similar. And at every step of the way, he rather than dismissing the idea, he felt that he was finding more evidence that that reinforced the idea that there was sutural movement. From then on,
if I can interrupt you, that must be quite difficult to show, though, isn't it? Because if you take apart the skull of a cadaver, the bones will not have the movement, even within the bone themselves, as they have in a live specimen.
This is true.
So, was he dealing with very fresh cadavers when he was doing this?
No, I don't think so. I've got some plastic models here, which might be of some help to sort of demonstrate. I mean, I'm holding up here for the sake of argument, and many viewers might be familiar with this anyway. Here's a plastic model of a temporal bone and a parietal bone. Well, if you open that out, there's a very much a scale-like shape to it. And if we look at the inside of the temporal bone, there's a corresponding scale-like shape. And it was this and an adjacent suture that Sutherland thought, well, it looks like the gills of a fish that move. There's a strong consistency amongst all skulls when you dismantle them, and there are certain places where there are minor variations, but the majority of sutural bevels are hugely consistent in skulls. You're quite right that he was looking at a dried specimen, which is like about 10 or 15% smaller and shrunken compared with it in life. But nonetheless, he was looking at the sutural architecture and thought...
It's a lot easier to see the movement in that particular suture than some of the others, the midline sutures and so on, isn't it? Because
indeed,
they are much more interlocked.
Well, yes. It depends on the sort of movement that you get. I mean, I haven't brought out of the stock the corresponding parietal bone, but we're now looking at the medial surface of the parietal bone where a corresponding one would be articulating. And these toothy, I'll turn it so that the camera can see it perhaps a little better, these toothy interdigitations allow for a hinging movement and a separational movement. But you wouldn't get gliding there, of course. Yeah. It just doesn't look like it would do it. So that's the different types of movement at different sutures.
Sorry, I interrupted you as you were explaining the philosophy.
So, Sutherland sort of went on from there's bony movement to experiment on his own head in a strange sort of way. This led him to realise that it wasn't just bony movement of the head, but in fact movement controlled by the lining dural membrane, which is anatomically really quite tough, and we might be looking at some pictures later which show fairly freshly dissected dural membrane. It's really tough stuff. And that has a coordinating effect on the cranial sutures, and indeed links the base of the skull to the sacrum, by what's referred to as the core link or the dural tube. So in many cases, if you get dysfunction at the sacrum, you'll get dysfunction at the cranial base and vice versa. Not always, but that's often the case.
You earlier on said that you wanted to get away from the concept that this was all about the head.
Yes.
And many people, even practitioners who are not osteopaths or chiropractors or anything else, will practice craniosacral therapy.
Sure.
But you choose not to call this a craniosacral approach.
If we can avoid it. I mean, I use both terms because it's convenient and I suppose in fairly popular usage these days. If I can sort of expand out on where I've got to with the story,
yes,
Sutherland, in his self-experimentation, eventually came to realise that there was something driving this from the inside. It wasn't just going along for the ride. And over many, many years, 30-odd years, he came to the conclusion that the combination of brain tissue and cerebrospinal fluid together had acted as a kind of motor, I suppose we can say. Now, bringing things up to a much more present day and thinking about material that's been published in the last few years, we now are inclined to see this as total body micromotion rather than it just being head, spinal dura, sacrum and being the craniosacral axis. We see involuntary movement, and that's why I prefer that term, as being tissue movement expressed throughout the body. The head happens to move to accommodate that micromotion in much the same way as any other part of the body. I refer particularly to my colleague, teaching team colleague David Hamm, who published about 4 years ago in iJOM and postulating a physiological mechanism linked to something called the Traubering-Mayer wave, which has been known of for over 100 years, but nobody really quite knew what it did. But we're beginning to see that maybe it has relevance. So coming back to what I was saying about a dialogue between the practitioner and the physician within, conducted through palpation and micromotion, we now perhaps interpret it as reading the micromotion in any tissue, probably expressed mainly through connective tissues, but as most of us know, something like 30% of the body's weight, if it was dried out, is connective tissue. So there's a lot of it about, and every bit of connective tissue connects with another bit of connective tissue, so it's a flexible subskeleton, really. And I think it's through connective tissues, whether they be hard connective tissues of bone or more flexible connective tissues such as dura mater, fascial planes, etc., that we're influencing body biomechanics and body physiology.
I remember finding that difficult to follow as an undergraduate because I thought there is so much involuntary movement in the soft tissues of the peripheral limbs, for example, whether you're just feeling a pulse or muscle twitches or whatever else, that I found it difficult to comprehend how people could feel an involuntary movement which is a craniosacral movement, a movement within the spinal column, if you like, at that extreme.
I agree with you, and as a teacher, it's difficult, it takes practice, and as you just said, there are a number of waveforms occurring in our bodies, a number of things that move our tissues rhythmically. This is just one of them. Obviously, breathing and heart rate are the obvious ones to identify. Heart rate's an easy one to ignore. Breathing less so because it's closer to the tissue movement that we're feeling. But I think it's a matter of focus, really. And an analogy I sometimes use when I'm teaching is in a room where there are conversations going on, it's a room with noise. But if you then switch your attention to a particular person's voice, or somebody mentions your name, your attention